This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Carole King, has had an extraordinary career as a songwriter and performer. With her first husband, lyricist Jerry Goffin, she wrote many hits for other performers in the 60s, including One Fine Day, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, Up on the Roof, A Natural Woman, Take Good Care of My Baby, The Locomotion, Don't Say Nothing Bad About My Baby, and I'm Into Something Good. In the late 60s, she stepped out from behind the scenes and started performing her own songs. Her 1971 album Tapestry broke the record for the best-selling album of all time. She's written a new memoir called A Natural Woman that reveals a lot about her music and is also surprisingly personal. When she was writing songs for other people, she used to make demo recordings in order to demonstrate what the song sounded like. A new album of 13 demos will be released April 24th. It also includes a few demos of songs she did on her album, Tapestry. Terry spoke with King last week and began with a demo of the song It's Too Late, recorded in 1970.
Stayed in bed all morning just to pass the time. There's something wrong here, there can be no denying. One of us is changing, or maybe we've just stopped trying. And it's too late, baby, now it's too late. Though we really did try to make it. Something
Carole King, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your new book. I don't want to derail this interview early on, but I just have to ask you something about me, something that pertains
Please,
to me.
Please, I welcome that, unlike many of your guests.
Okay, so there's so much fascinating information in your book about music and your personal life, but one thing of special interest to me, which is that I think I grew up about six blocks away from you in Brooklyn. You were on 24th Street. I was on 29th Street in the same area. And
seriously?
You went to Shellbank Junior High and so did I. Did you go to PS 98 Elementary School?
No, I went to PS 206.
Okay.
Oh, my. I had no idea, and I love knowing that.
I had no idea either. So my question for you is, do you remember... You're a little older than me, but so it might not have existed yet, but do you remember the Shellbank Junior High alma mater?
No, I don't. I went there the first year that Shellbank opened, so no, I don't.
Okay, well, probably wasn't.
Do you?
Yes, I'm not going to sing it.
Would you sing it for me?
No, I won't, but I will recite, because I know you love music, I will recite the bridge, which is a march. And it goes, as we entered seventh grade, green as raw recruits, on our journey through the years, we planted sturdy roots. We learned about democracy and citizenship's demands. We're firm in our devotion to our parents, teachers, friends. Then at Shellbank Junior High, we challenge all comparison, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, you know what? When you said Shellbank Junior High, I kind of hear the melody in my mind, so it must have existed. And I have blocked out all memory of it.
So what's kind of relevant about this is that schools, high schools in Brooklyn, including the one you went to, James Madison, often did something called Sing, in which each grade would put on, like, their own version of a Broadway show. There'd be a storyline, and it would be a musical, and you'd use melodies from Broadway shows and write your own lyrics. And you participated in Sing, and that was probably your first experience actually writing songs that were going to be performed.
I think I did a little of that in my childhood, but in any big way, yes. I mean, because my mother put on shows, and she would sometimes include a little something, you know, that I wrote. But my mother was, you know, herself a writer, among many things, and she was a very talented woman. And so I did some of that. But yeah, the Sing turned out to be it became my place of identification, because I was a few years younger than most of my fellow students, and I really wanted to be popular, and I didn't see a vehicle or way in which I could be popular. Nobody really took me seriously. They said, oh, she's so cute, and not in the sense that they mean it today, like hot or attractive, but like dismissive. And I was like, no, I don't want to be cute. I want to be beautiful, and everybody should see me as beautiful and smart and whatever, and that wasn't happening. And then I connected through music.
I was struck reading your book by how much courage you had. As, you know, a young teenager, you used to go to all the Alan Freed shows, and Alan Freed was a very famous disc jockey, like rock and roll and R&B disc jockey at the time, and he would have these rock and roll shows in which the top acts would perform. And
yeah, like a list of each show was like a who's who of who was popular then or who was going to be popular, and sure enough, they all were.
And you wanted to be part of that world, so you had your father, who was a New York City firefighter, and could kind of get access to people. He set you up a little meeting with Alan Freed, and you told him you wanted to write songs. He told you to look up the names of record companies in the phone book and then find an A&R man, an artisan repertoire man who signs people, and perform some songs for him. And so you found Atlantic Records in the phone book and got a meeting there. What were the songs that you were performing then? Because you also met with Don Costa at ABC Paramount. He gave you a contract. You recorded, I think, a couple of singles. Can you just sing a few bars of one of those really early songs that
no.
are pretty... What? Is that because you don't want to sing or because you don't want to
no,
expose the
no,
songs?
I think I just feel silly singing those songs, but they are available, widely available on YouTube, as I've found out. I mean, there's songs like Goin' Wild and Babysittin' and Under the Stars and The Right Girl. Those are the titles of the two sides of the two singles. But no, I don't want to sing them today.
Do you mind if we play one?
Not at all.
Okay, which one would you like to hear?
I can't pick one. You go ahead and pick one, honestly.
Okay, let's try Babysitting.
Okay, I have a story about that, which is to say, if you hear the lyrics to Babysitting, you will know why I desperately needed a lyricist, and I found one. I found one in Queens.
Okay, so let's hear Babysitting, and then we'll talk about finding one. That's one of Carole King's very early songs before she met her first lyricist, Jerry Goffin, who became her husband. Carole King has a new memoir. It's called A Natural Woman. So it's a great story how you found Jerry Goffin. Tell us how you found him.
Well, my family announced we were living in Brooklyn, and my family announced that we were moving to Queens, and I have a line in the book that, Queens? What could there possibly be in Queens? Well, as it turns out, quite a few wonderful things, including Paul Simon, who I met first before I met Jerry. Paul Simon and I went to Queens College in the same, class. We were both freshmen, as was Art, but I didn't know Art very well then. And Paul and I sort of got together and formed this little group that we called the Cousins. We didn't actually do anything except help other people with their demos or, play. He played bass and guitar. I played piano. We both sang, and we helped people out making demos. And sometimes they'd pay us $25, which Paul said we'd have done it for free. But Paul and I never wrote together. It is astonishing to me now, but when I asked him years later, he said he wasn't much of a collaborator, and he didn't think he could write very good lyrics until Sounds of Silence went to number one. Hello. But so that was not where I found my lyricist, oddly enough, but I met Jerry Goffin at Queens College, and that is where I found a great lyricist. He was just outstanding.
So you started writing songs together, you the melodies, he the music. Did you know right away, like, this was your lyricist? And what was it about his lyrics that made you realize he was good?
In order of questions, yes, I did know. And what made it him so extraordinary as a lyricist was his ability to say in really simple words big ideas, big feelings, big thoughts. And the thing, for example, "Will You Love Me Tomorrow?" You just listen to the lyric of the first verse, "Tonight you're mine completely. You give your love so sweetly. Tonight the light of love is in your eyes. But will you love me tomorrow?" Is that not what every teenage girl is thinking? You know, he had the ability. He's a straight man, and he had the ability to get inside a woman's head and say the things women were thinking. Natural Woman is another example, and one he didn't write with me, Saving All My Love for You.
You did some great demos, and in fact, a bunch of your demos are being released very shortly. And it's fascinating to hear the demos that you made for other artists, because when you and Jerry Goffin were writing together, you were writing for other performers. And you'd have to kind of, you describe this in the book, like you'd channel their voices in your mind and write a song that seemed suitable for them. And then you'd do the demo. And in some of the demos, it was just like you and the piano. And what I find most interesting about the demos is how you often had the whole arrangement in your head, that you're not just writing melody and chords. You're hearing the arrangement that's later fleshed out with, you know, full instrumentation. When a song comes to you, do you usually hear it fleshed out like that?
Not always. It comes in stages. And also, again, credit to Jerry, who, though not musical in the ways we know people as musical, like he can't really sing very well, and he had a way of communicating to me what it was he heard. And so it's not just my vision, it's his that's incorporated, which our vision actually became one thing, which is probably why we were a couple. But it comes in stages many times. And one of the things that I do back in the songwriting day and later when I was an artist is things do come to me, and often I don't know what the next thing is going to be until I lay down the first thing. So I do that with laying down the piano, and you mentioned the overdub piano. I do that with layers of voices, which Lou Adler, when I was making Tapestry, had the ability to just quietly make a suggestion. Why don't you layer your voice? And with each new layer, I heard new parts. So it's a wonderful process for me.
So I want to play a demo that I think is particularly interesting. And so I'm going to play Take Good Care of My Baby from your new demos album, and then play the hit version by Bobby V. So the hit version was from 1961, and you demoed it just before that. So here's Carole King, followed by Bobby V.
My tears are falling 'cause you've taken her away. Ever make her cry. Just let your love surround her, paint a rainbow all around her. Don't let her see a cloudy sky. Once upon a time, that little girl was mine. If I'd been true, I know she'd never be with you. So take good care of my baby.
I love that you did that, because to me, as a songwriter and the maker of the demo, that is my joy. If I hear the vision and I get it onto a demo and they run with it, that is my joy.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Carole King. King has a new memoir called A Natural Woman, named after the song she wrote with her first husband, Jerry Goffin, that was a big hit for Aretha Franklin. That song is also included on her new album of demos, which will be released later this month. Let's hear that version of A Natural Woman.
Looking out on the morning rain,
your memoir, Natural Woman, is a lot about music, but it's also about your personal life. And I think you have some really interesting things to say. As a successful woman in a career that very few women worked in, the music business. So let's talk a little bit about that side of your life, if that's okay.
Sure.
So let's start with your marriage to Jerry Goffin. You were collaborators and life partners. That's, in the best of circumstances, I think...
a challenge today, yes.
Yes, right, exactly. And you started off as teenagers, just to add to the challenge. And to add to the challenge again, it was during the marriage that, you know, the whole, you know, counterculture starts to explode. And in the meantime, like, you're married, you have a couple of children, you're living in the suburbs. He didn't really want that life. He wanted to be part of, you know, the revolution. And so he starts heading in that direction. And you feel like you're tying him down, and that at the same time you're not being like the kind of wife that would allow him to be free, to, like, home, making food, you know, doing all that stuff, because you're a professional, you're working. And again, like, you didn't have the language yet to to articulate all of that. And then to add to that, he started getting paranoid and having, you know, psychological problems. What made you realize that these were just, like, real psychological problems that had to be dealt with?
Well, when you have someone in the family with that kind of problem, you do have to deal with it. And you know, when I was first having to deal with it, I was 23 and he was 26, and we had these two little children. And it was definitely, there was no blueprint. I had really no one to turn to for that. But I also want to say, I mean, the psychological problems, I don't know which triggered what, but he also took LSD, and I think somebody slipped it to him, but I can't go beyond saying I suspect, but that was part of the trigger too. But I also want to say that the times, I know, I have since found out, you know, that a lot of my contemporaries at that time, maybe each person or couple thinking that they were alone and feeling these things, you have a couple where one member of the marriage or the relationship was drawn to the counterculture, and the other was like, but wait, what's happening? You know, we were a couple, and now you want to go do all these things that the 60s, you know, invited.
You divorced in about 1967, was it?
Yeah, and that was, again, part of the times. We just couldn't stay together. It just wasn't going to happen. And what happened was Jerry decided to move to California, and I saw California as my future as well, and I made the move also, and most of all because I didn't want our daughters to be far from their father.
So you not only didn't have a husband at that point, you didn't have a musical collaborator either.
Not at the time, but I had met somebody, Ms. Toni Stern. I always have to put the Ms. so we know she's a female. I had met her and worked with her prior to Jerry's and my breakup. And so I began working with her, and she wrote It's Too Late. She wrote the lyrics, Where You Lead. She wrote the lyrics to that. And I think those are the two on Tapestry. But we had some hits together, including The Carpenters' It's Going to Take Some Time This Time. So I really had kind of a new lease on life, a new hope. And Jerry and I stayed in touch. You know, we had the children, and our divorce was not a contentious divorce. It was just hard for me to work with him for a little while. But then I started working with him again. I worked with Toni, and then I worked with David Palmer, who was in a group called The Middle Class that we had met and worked with when we lived in New Jersey.
And that was the band that your second husband was in, right?
As it happens, yes. My second husband was the bass player in that band. That was Charlie Larkey. And we had a great time while we were together. We had a great musical experience, a great relationship. And we are still, I call our relationship an unconventional success story, because we didn't stay married, but we stayed friends and cooperative co-parents. And we even made music together after we were not married anymore. And we're still just great friends, and we still love each other, and it's just a wonderful thing to have in one's life.
I love hearing that. So at what point did you think, I'm going to write lyrics myself?
Well, the first time I thought that was when Jerry and I were having problems, and we still lived in New Jersey, and the lyrics were abysmal. I hated what I was writing, and I was like, don't even bother. The second time was when I was in California and under James's influence and out on the road with him in these college gigs, and I found myself missing Charlie. By then, Charlie and I were married, and I wrote So Far Away, and I thought, you know, I think this is going to work. I'm going to keep writing, and that was the beginning of my career as a solo writer.
So why don't we hear So Far Away, and this is from Carole King's Tapestry album.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door. Doesn't help to know you're just time away. Long ago I reached for you and there you stood. Holding you again could only do me good. How I wish I could, but you're so far away. One more song about moving along the highway. Can't say much of it. If I could only work this life out my way, I'd rather spend it being close to you. But you're so far away. Doesn't anybody.
So that's Carole King, So Far Away, from her album Tapestry. And Carole King has a new memoir called A Natural Woman. Do you remember the first time you heard one of your records on the radio?
Yes, I do. It was Will You Love Me Tomorrow, and Jerry and I were in what was his and then became our 56 Mercury Monterey, and we're listening to this coming out of the tinny speakers, and we're like, oh my God, I can't believe this. We were just through the roof and to the moon. It was just such a thrill. But I'll tell you what, that doesn't go away. When I made an album called Love Makes the World, the first time I heard the single Love Makes the World, which I wrote with two guys in New York, two New York hip-hop guys, I felt the same feeling of like, wow, it's out there. It's on the radio.
Carole King, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Carole King speaking with Terry Gross. Her new memoir is called A Natural Woman. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. King's collection of demo recordings is being released April 24th. Speaking of prolific songwriters, Bonnie Raitt has just released a new album called Slipstream. It's her first since Souls Alike in 2005. Raitt produced most of the album herself, which is unusual. Rock critic Ken Tucker says this return to recording and her renewed control over her music has resulted in one of Raitt's finest albums.
You know that I need your love. You got that hold over me. As long as I've got your love, you know I'll never leave. I wanted you to share my life. I had no doubt in my mind. And it's been you.
The warmth and vigor of Bonnie Raitt's voice throughout her new album Slipstream, even when she's covering an oldie such as Jerry Rafferty's Right Down the Line, is vital and fresh, urgent even. Raitt has always possessed a gift for taking a familiar phrase and rendering it in a manner that compels a listener to think anew about what the words really mean. Listen to the way she takes this song co-written by Joe Henry and Loudon Wainwright III and sings the lyric with all of the precision and emotion her father, John Raitt, might have given a Broadway show tune that was as well written as this.
I know that fan is moving air. I can see it in your hair. But I can't bear to breathe it in somehow. I'll rise and fall with you, 'cause you can't fail. The stain of love's a smudge upon my brow. But you see through me, and you can't fail me now.
Raitt has always mixed folk with the blues and rock and the sort of funk that she would probably link to Lowell George and Little Feat, and I'd say is as respectful of beat and groove as any of the R&B artists she admires. You can hear it in her slide guitar playing throughout this album, and particularly the way she sets up the rhythm with her band and then slides her voice into it, like a letter going into an envelope addressed to you. I know that if you're going to praise a Bonnie Raitt album, you're supposed to work in some comparison to her greatest commercial success, the multiple Grammy winner Nick of Time from 1989. But my praise is more precise. This is Raitt's best album since her underrated 1975 collection, Home Plate. I'm not just pulling that out for obscurity's sake, either. This new album, Slipstream, captures the kind of barnstorming fervor that can turn in the space of a song to a slow boil, the roiling storm of emotions contained within this cover of Bob Dylan's Million Miles.
You took a part of me that I really miss. I keep asking myself, how long can it go on like this? You told yourself a lie. That's all right, I told myself one, two. Well, I try to get closer, but I'm still a million miles from you.
I mentioned Bonnie Raitt's vocals at the start of this review, and I'm going to end there too. It's not that I'm ageist enough to think it remarkable that someone in her 60s can sing as fluidly as Raitt does here. Heck, her blues heroes were doing it for a few decades beyond that. But it is rare for a performer who's maintained a 40-year career to manage to sound so unfazed, so careful to avoid artistic shortcuts, so lacking in cynicism. She has the guile and shrewdness of a longtime pro, but it's the, yes, purity of this beautiful mongrel music that gives it its great life.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Bonnie Raitt's new album called Slipstream. Coming up, Major League pitcher R.A. Dickey talks about what it took for him to stop worrying and love the knuckleball. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, R.A. Dickey, is a baseball curiosity, the only guy in the big leagues who relies on the knuckleball, a pitch that dips, dives, and swerves in ways that make it hard to catch and harder to hit. Dickey explains how he mastered the pitch in a new memoir, but the book is more than a baseball story. He reveals his troubled youth and childhood sexual abuse, his retreat into the refuge of sports, and years of struggle in the minor leagues, trying to become a quality big league pitcher. Dickey eventually got there, in part, he believes, because he got help in dealing with demons from his past, and because he finally figured out that crazy pitch, the knuckleball. At age 37, Dickey is now in the starting rotation for the New York Mets and is one of the most effective pitchers in the game. He's also featured in a new documentary called Knuckleball, which premieres April 21st. His new memoir with writer Wayne Coffey is called Wherever I Wind Up, My Quest for Truth, Authenticity, and the Perfect Knuckleball. Well, R.A. Dickey, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk about the knuckleball. Not many people throw it. Now, you know, most – there are a lot of pitches that pitchers throw, conventional pitches, that are designed to break or dip or dive. What distinguishes the knuckleball from all those other pitches?
Well, the knuckleball is very unique in that as a conventional pitcher, you throw a fastball, a curveball, a slider, or a changeup. And those pitches are all thrown with a certain amount of spin on them. You're trying to impart spin on the baseball in order to manipulate the break whichever way you'd like. With a knuckleball, you're doing the opposite. You're taking spin completely off the baseball, and you're kind of leaving it up to the physics of air resistance and seams on the baseball and the way that the air impacts the leather and the indentations on the baseball make the ball move. And so when you throw a knuckleball, a perfectly thrown knuckleball has a little less than a quarter rotation from the time that it leaves your hand until the time that it gets to the catcher's mitt. And that's a very tough mechanic to get down. It's a very hard pitch to be consistent. And so that's why you don't see a whole lot of knuckleballers around, I think.
Right. Now, and if you execute that well and get the ball started toward the plate without spin, how does it behave? Why is it effective?
Well, I've heard it said that, you know, a knuckleball is like trying to hit a butterfly in a typhoon. you know, it shakes side to side. It may go straight left on one pitch. It may go down and into a right-handed hitter on another pitch. It may stay on the very same plane the whole way on one pitch. So the thing that makes a knuckleball effective is that you cannot predict which way the ball is going to move, which makes it an extremely hard pitch to hit as well as a hard pitch to throw.
Right. Now, how do you grip it?
Well, I grip my knuckleball in the way that Joe Necro, Phil Necro, and Tim Wakefield grip theirs. And I tutored under Charlie Huff, who was a longtime knuckleballer for the Dodgers and the Rangers, the White Sox, and the Florida Marlins. And I take my pointer finger and my middle finger, and I dig my fingernails beneath the horseshoe of the baseball. There's a seam on the baseball that runs over the circumference of the ball, and it makes a shape of a horseshoe on one particular part. I take my fingernails, and I dig them in the leather, and I take my thumb, I put it on the side, and my index finger on the other side, and I use those points as stability points so that when I throw the baseball, I keep my wrist very stiff, and when I release it, I try to release it at the opportune moment where there's no spin on it. And so if you can do that over and over and over again, then usually you're going to have a pretty good game. It's when the ball starts rotating a little bit or tumbling forward, and the hitter can pick up that tumbling and predict where the ball is going to end up and hit it very hard. If you throw a good knuckleball, you can make the best hitters in the world look very foolish.
Yeah, have you had particular moments that you enjoyed them flailing away at a good
indeed.
Knuckleball?
Indeed. I've thrown a few times a knuckleball, to a left-handed hitter in particular, where I've thrown the pitch and it had zero spin on it, and they've actually swung the bat and the ball has broken after they've swung and actually hit them. So they've swung and it's hit them on either the back of the leg or back foot. Or one time I hit a guy in the waist and he swung at the pitch. And when they're swinging at the pitch and it ends up hitting them, you know you've got some pretty good movement that day.
Yeah, and they often lose the bat, right? Because they're just so out of control.
Yeah, oftentimes they'll sling the bat into the stands, which has happened on a few occasions as well.
Now, the conventional pitcher is always trying to hit a spot. I mean, you work the corners of the strike zone. You don't want to leave it in the fat part of the plate. The knuckleball is a pitch that, by design, is unpredictable. What do you aim for?
Well, I try to get it started at the right height. I think, for me, that's what's most important. It's impossible, and any knuckleball pitcher, true knuckleball pitcher, will tell you, it's impossible to be able to throw a knuckleball on the outside corner. You just simply get it started in the right direction at the right height, and the ball's going to do what the ball's going to do. I aim for about two baseballs above the catcher's helmet. And if I can get the ball going on that trajectory, I know more or less if it's going to fall within the strike zone. And the key to throwing a knuckleball, and Charlie Huff told me the first day I ever worked with him, he said, it took me one day to learn how to throw a knuckleball and a lifetime to throw a knuckleball for strikes. So you got to be able to throw strikes with the pitch so that the hitter will respect you. That's the rub. And so I start my knuckleball about two balls above the catcher's helmet.
You grew up in Nashville, you tell us in this book, and your dad left your mom early, and your mom had a drinking problem, used to take you to a bar called Joe's Village Inn. And, you know, it's gotten a lot of attention in the book that you revealed that you were abused sexually in your childhood, you know, once, well, repeatedly by a teenage girl who was your babysitter when you were 8 years old, and then on another occasion, more brutally, by a 17-year-old boy. This is tough stuff. Did you tell anybody about these incidents at the time?
No, I didn't. In fact, it wasn't for 23 years until I uttered a word of it to anybody. I think one of the tough things about being sexually abused is you right away you feel like you've been a part of something incredibly wicked, that you've had something to do with it. Even I now know it has nothing to do with any fault of your own, but you certainly feel like it was partially your fault. And so I always just stuffed it away and would build up mechanisms for dealing with that pain.
You became a great athlete. I mean, you were a great athlete. You played, you know, sports, many of them well in junior high and high school. Did you think much about the abuse at the time, or had you repressed it or thought you'd repressed it?
Well, I certainly had repressed it, but you can't really repress something like that to the extent that you never think about it. And one of the mechanisms that I had developed was pouring myself into athletics. You know, the baseball field, the basketball court, and the football field were all kind of my refuges, places I would take sanctuary from the pain of feeling like, you know, I was a fractured, less than human person. You know, I mean, that's what you're given when you're sexually abused. That's what you feel like. You feel like you're not worth anything. And so I would try to gain back some of that worth by pouring myself into athletics in a way that was, that time's probably pretty dysfunctional.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with big league pitcher and knuckleballer R.A. Dickey. He's a starter for the New York Mets, and he has a new memoir. It's called Wherever I Wind Up, My Quest for Truth, Authenticity, and the Perfect Knuckleball. Now, you become a first-round draft choice for the Texas Rangers. That's a prestigious place to be for a kid entering the big leagues. So your dreams are coming true. You're going to be financially secure in a way you never have been. And then it all falls apart. What happened?
Well, when I flew down to take my comprehensive physical, which all first-rounders do, they did this test called the valgus stress test, where you put your elbow into this apparatus and they apply pressure from the back and they take an x-ray from the top. And it revealed that I had a little bit extra laxity in my right elbow and that joint than my left elbow. By the time I had left the doctor's office and got to the general manager's office to sign my contract in Arlington, Texas, the doctor and the general manager had talked, and my agent was there, and we were going up the elevator, and you know, I'm thinking I'm about to throw out the first pitch of the game, meet Nolan Ryan, who was my boyhood idol, and sign my contract. Doug Melvin was the general manager at the time, called my agent into the office. And I went on and stood out on the balcony and watched batting practice take place while my agent and the general manager talked. Well, the agent comes out of the office and gets me, and he's got kind of a pale look on his face and says, "We need to go in here right away." And I sit down across from Doug Melvin, and Doug Melvin commenced to say that they were going to take the offer off the table because they felt like there was something wrong with my arm. And of course, in that moment, you know, I was having a million different emotions, least of which was to jump over the table and choke him to death, because I'd spent a lifetime trying to get to that very point, and he was taking it all away. At least that was what I thought. But I quieted my spirit, and thankfully I didn't burn a bridge in that moment, and I went on to see Dr. Andrews in Birmingham, Alabama the next day, and sure enough, the MRI came back that I didn't have the existence of an ulnar collateral ligament in my right elbow at all, which is the ligament inside the elbow that keeps that joint stable. And I went back to Nashville, Tennessee, thinking that I may never throw for a professional team ever again. So my options became go back to school for my senior year. I'd been drafted after my junior year of college, go back for my senior year and try to play well enough to get drafted again, albeit it would not have been in a high round. And about 24 hours before my first class at the University of Tennessee, the general manager, Doug Melvin, called my agent and said, "We'll give him $75,000, take it or leave it." And I prayed about it and talked about it with Ann, who is my wife now, and felt led to take the contract. And so I did, and started my professional career as kind of this freak that didn't have the ulnar collateral ligament.
So you described the moment that you made this transition to being a knuckleball pitcher. I mean, two greats of the game, you know, Buck Showalter and Oral Hershiser, tell you, "We think, you know, you've been fooling around with this pitch, you can do it well." And then you begin on the, in a way in the second pitching career, learning it. And it's a hard craft to master, and you went up to the big leagues a few times and did well, but also got knocked around plenty. When it isn't working, it's a rough day on the mound.
Sure.
And you ended up back in the minors again, and there's this bizarre, I don't know if we could call it a turning point in your career, that involved you trying to swim across the Missouri River in Iowa. What happened?
Oh, man. What didn't happen? That's exactly right. What happened? Well, you know, I had been coming. Like I said, I spent so much time in Oklahoma City. One of the places we would always play was Omaha. We would play the Royals. And the Omaha Royals, which was the AAA affiliate of the Kansas City Royals. And I'd been going through there for years. And we always stayed at this hotel. And it overlooked the Missouri River. And for years, I would go up the elevators looking out over the river thinking, "I wonder if anybody can swim across that." Well, in 2007, I thought, "I'm going to do it. You know, I've spent a lifetime of not taking any risks. I'm going to take one and try to do it." And so word spread around the clubhouse, and all my teammates got out there, and they watched me derobe and get down into the shallows of the Missouri before I took off and tried to traverse it.
It's a big, fast-moving river, right? What happened?
Well, it's it is big, it's dirty, and it's fast moving, and it's come to find out has a significant undertow. But I set out, and I'd always been a pretty good swimmer. I felt like I was going at a pretty good clip, and you know, I'd gone about 100 yards upriver, so that I felt like if I got across, you know, I would kind of be in the place I needed to be that would look right across the hotel to the hotel from the other side. And I thought, after I'd been swimming for about, you know, what seemed to be 4 or 5 minutes, I thought I'd come up and take a peek. And so when I did, I realized all of a sudden that the river had swept me very far downriver. And my teammates, who were once standing right in front of me at 6 feet tall, just about, were now looked like little ants on the horizon. I mean, it was really a really scary moment. Well, I get out almost to the middle. By this time, I'm thinking I have zero shot at getting to the other side. And so I turn around, and I know at that point when I turn around that it's going to be a fight just to stay alive. And things took on a much less jovial feel. You know, every stroke was, you know, a determined stroke to try to survive an experience where I may drown. And so I got close to the shore, and I had kind of given myself over to the fact that this was it. You know, I wasn't going to make it. And I closed my eyes and started to sink. And I remember writing a line in the book, "The sensation of weeping underwater was a real interesting sensation." And I was praying that God, you know, would protect my family and all that. I'd come to grips with dying and started sinking. And right as I was about to open my mouth and take in all this water just to end it quickly, my feet hit the bottom of the river, and it kind of renewed my adrenaline, and I surged up, and I was probably about 14 feet high. Of course, the water's so deep, I mean dark, you don't really know where you are. And I boosted myself up and did that repeatedly, dog pedal a little more, and then made one more furious attempt to try to get to the side. And one of my teammates had followed me all the way down river, named Grant Balfour. And if it weren't for him, I wouldn't be talking to you today, Dave. But he stuck out his arm, and I reached up and grabbed it, and he pulled me to shore, and I survived.
Now, this was a near-death experience. I mean, you almost didn't get out of that river alive. And it's fascinating that after that experience, your pitching got better. Why do you think?
I know. You know, I certainly look at it as almost a baptism of sorts, you know. I mean, I went into the Missouri River. I was hanging on by a thread professionally. I was like 1-4 at the time with a 6-something ERA, which is not very good in baseball at all. And I was one phone call from the general manager away from being released and never playing baseball again, maybe. And when I came out of the river, I ended up going 11-2 with like a 2.80 ERA and became the PCL Pitcher of the Year.
That's Pacific and Coast League, yeah.
Terrific season. And I say that only to emphasize the point that, you know, I think when I came out of the river, I was so consumed with just wanting to live in the present well that I think that carried over directly into my pitching. And I just cared about each pitch singularly. And so, you know, if one pitch didn't go well, forget it. Here's this pitch. What am I going to do with this pitch? And when I did that over and over and over again, I was able to look back, and all of a sudden I was putting together a pretty incredible run. And I decided that that's how I wanted to live my life.
Well, R.A. Dickey, you know, we're speaking to you from Philadelphia, and I just don't think my daughter would let me wish a New York Met a successful season. But what I am going to say, I wish you the best, and it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
R.A. Dickey's new memoir is called Wherever I Wind Up, written with Wayne Coffey. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.